fine.
Okay.
Oh, good. So it's just recording, so they don't see that my, I have no, there's no video.
Well, I want to welcome you all to our final colloquium, actually, of the semester, and to thank all of you for coming, and especially those of you who have come every week or multiple weeks. It's been really great, and I hope that you've benefited from it immensely. Our final speaker is Dr. Romick Baldwin. She is a professor in the English department here at the University of Dallas, and she will be talking about an interesting concept at the end. So, I look forward to hearing her.
Thank you very much. And thank you to Tiffany and to Matt Spring, the father of this series, and to Tiffany for organizing it this year. What insight and energy and insight from both of you. So thank you very much to both of them. Welcome to the last talk in the Writing Colloquia series, as Mrs. Niebuhr mentioned. What do you expect from a last talk? Should it be related or not related to what came before? My title, Something Interesting at the End, I think it was something to that effect, set up expectations that it will contain something new. But if I had entitled it Conclusion, what would you expect there? Would you expect, I would think, maybe a recap of previous talks? I could provide a montage, get some music playing, sort of montage music. I could describe how the series began with Dr. Kreider holding up the vision of writing as reader-friendly, soul-shaping rhetoric, of Dr. Waterman Ward celebrating the elegant potential of parallel structure, of Mrs. Niebuhr inviting you to consider the beauty of logical transitions, of Mr. Spring exhorting you to think about the actions of your sentences and to express them using active verbs, of Mr. Marchetti exploring how to set up an introduction that propels your reader into having a stake in your paper, of Mr. Foreman considering how important it is to choose the words you quote carefully and then to slow down and comment on them. Or should the last talk be on just the topic of conclusions, which would seem to be appropriate at this point in the series? What do we expect at the end? What do we want at the end? In order to answer that question, I'd like you to look at sentence number one of your handout. And I want you to think of it. Which one of the sentence one and two, which one of the following sentences comes from an essay more sympathetic to Dido, if we assume for the moment that duty and love are both good things? One, although Dido follows love, Aeneas follows duty. Two, although Aeneas follows duty, Dido follows love. What do you expect will follow each of the sentences? Which one of these do you think Dido would prefer us to start an essay about her? Raise your hand if it's number one. Raise your hand if it's number two. Yeah, I think that's exactly true. That there's something about the end of the sentence which will emphasize that that is the critical, important information. Because when you write, it is. I don't really like thinking of writing as information. That's sort of dry, dry language. And so I use that language very tentatively. But you are trying to say something new. You're trying to see it in a new light. And where the reader expects that information to come is at the end. So the reader is going to be confused, by the way, if the writer of the second sentence, although Aeneas follows duty, Dido follows love, continues with the third sentence. Let me read those together. That is to say, the second sentence followed by the third. Although Aeneas follows duty, Dido follows love. When he appears to forget, Jupiter sends Mercury to remind him. Okay, let's just pretend those two sentences were in sequence. It would confuse you a little bit, right? Somebody who had not read the Aeneid might think that Dido's a guy, right? It's like, Dido follows love. When he appears to forget, it seems to go back to Dido. And I always thought that too. Dido sounds like a guy name. I don't know. Anyhow, on the other hand, sentence three follows sentence number one quite smoothly. Although Dido follows love, Aeneas follows duty. When he appears to forget, Jupiter sends Mercury to remind him. Am I agreeing? You could follow that one, right? Yes? Pretty much? Yes. Okay. The reader expects that the new and important thought or idea will come at the end of the sentence. Joseph Williams called this part of the sentence the stress position, the place where new ideas or information are stressed. And I'm not sure if he coined the phrase. The concept itself is very old. He didn't make it up. Isn't that Matt? Oh no, you. No, because I was a quizzical. You had that look as though you knew who coined it. It's like, tell me. I almost thought that I was going to title it "Stress Position," there were some problems with that. If you Google stress position, in fact, it's a technical phrase used to describe the form of torturing prisoners. And secondly, it's November at UD, which is enough stress without adding a talk by the same name. Anyhow, plus that I couldn't resist the surprise of just having a mystery topic that you might want to show up to, having been bored with perhaps, I don't want to say being bored, let me retract that. Can I reverse this and delete? But just worried that these might be repeated ideas that you had heard before. Let me just give you a few other examples. Take four and five together, just to prove my point. I like the cold. Today is very, very cold. Today is very, very cold. I like the cold. I mean, it's pretty clear that they're very different. They seem to together express very different attitudes towards the cold. Take six and seven together. Andromache advises the Trojans in Book 6 to maintain a defensive position. And many books later, Polydamas offers the same advice, which Hector himself unwisely ignores. And then seven. Polydamas advises the Trojans to maintain a defensive position, advice which Hector himself unwisely ignores. Advice which Andromache had offered back in Book 6. You can see the second sentence is certainly going to focus on Andromache and the fact that she is perhaps wiser than one might think. The exact same information is being conveyed. All I've done is switched it around, and yet the effect is very, very different. And then look again at 8 and 9. The Odyssey offers a dazzling world of monsters and deceptions that causes us to explore the quest for truth. But the Iliad strikes more forcefully at the violence and vulnerability of our human condition. Versus, the Iliad strikes more forcefully at the violence and vulnerability of our human condition. But the Odyssey offers a dazzling world of monsters and deceptions that causes us to explore the quest for truth. Same words. Totally same words, but you get the sense that they're going to be opposite essays. One of them's going to be arguing for the Iliad and the importance of the fragility of our condition and the action of our context and the importance of war and tragedy and our violence and death in our lives. The other one's going to be about philosophy. It's going to be about them quest for truth. So I'm hoping these examples so far at least convince you that there's something to this concept. And what I wanted to do today was just to think about this concept and how it applies on the level of the sentence, on the level of the paragraph, and on the level of the document. Now, I've already discussed how this works on the level of the sentence. And I just want to now follow through with the corollary, another piece of information, as it were. Because if the end of the sentence is stress position, then what's at the beginning?
Usually an opinion which you'd like to contrast or counter-argument, and which you'd like to juxtapose against your concluding thought.
Some sort of juxtaposition. It could take many forms. Thank you, Francis. It can take many forms. It might be a contrast, like the although. It might just be old information. Although Dido follows love doesn't necessarily mean that it's wrong to follow love, but it does mean that previously you can assume that the reader, you're setting that up as the context in which now you're going to claim that Aeneas follows duty. So it's kind of setting up a bit of context for your reader to understand that stress position, that new information at the end. Example number one implies that we already know that Dido follows love, and now we want to introduce another sort of motivation, duty. But now if we follow it, as we did before, with sentence number three, notice what happens to duty. Although Dido follows love, Aeneas follows duty. When he appears to forget, Jupiter sends Mercury to remind him. Okay, when he appears to forget. Appears to forget what? Slowball. Duty, yes, thank you very much. Duty has now become the old information. And this makes the reader so happy to have some old information. Oh, I get that, right? When he appears to forget this duty, because the duty is implied there, then we introduce something else. Now, the idea of background information is something that gifted students and advanced students often forget about. They are so focused on the new ideas that they are generating, on the dazzling new insights that they are discovering, that, and I don't mean that sarcastically, I mean that truly. You know, you get really excited about an idea and you want to put those ideas out on the page. That such a student forgets that the reader cannot be a mind reader and often needs some help understanding where the new insight fits, why it's important. Now, be careful here. By background information, I am not saying that you need to summarize the entire poem or to offer a big extended historical context before introducing your point. Rather, I'm just saying that you need to set up your reader with just enough contrast that your new claim is going to make sense as being new or interesting. Now, let's move on that note to level two, the level of linking your sentences into a paragraph. Now, some of you are probably thinking, wait a minute, the topic sentence goes first, right? You don't want to have your topic sentence at the end. Speaker after speaker has told you to have a topic sentence. Am I suggesting then that you should put the topic sentence last? No, 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 no. I repeat, no. Readers still need a signpost for a paragraph, something that is going to situate them and guide them where you want them to go. But when you do craft the topic sentence, please be mindful of stress position, because as we saw, any of those previous sentences, well, I don't know about the cold ones, but the ones about the Aeneid, any of those could function as a topic sentence, but a topic sentence to a very different paragraph. That said, there is one paragraph in which the reader expects you to follow the stress position rule absolutely rigidly. Which one is that? Introduction. Yes, exactly. Thank you. That is the perfect example of a stress position on a paragraph level, which the reader is expecting. Because if you bury your main point in the middle of your introduction, the reader is going to lose it. Why? Because the reader expects it at the end, and the reader is going to be reading that last sentence over and over if it's a good reader, or just sort of blowing by it if it's a bad reader, thinking that last sentence is your point. And so sometimes students will, you know, do a counter argument or something, you know, some bit of example that sort of elaborates on the point without actually forcefully putting that main point in that last sentence position of that first paragraph. And if you do that, it squanders that position. But back to the other paragraphs. How does the stress position concept help us write them? Well, I've already suggested it when I linked sentence 1 and 3. Stress position, understanding where the reader expects to find the old and new information in a sentence, we can more smoothly link our sentences together, because linking sentences requires a judicious balance of old and new information. Let me give you an example of a sequence of sentences in which all the information is new, in order to show you that having all new information is very disorienting. And notice I just gave you the point of my paragraph. I said, here's the point. Read the sentence with this in mind. I'm going to read this example, and you're going to be disoriented, as opposed to just reading it and having you get disoriented and anxious. See, so I'm trying to de-stress. Not distress, de-stress you. All right, here it goes. Number 10. Dido falls in love. Jupiter sends Mercury to remind Aeneas of his duty. Because Virgil is writing under the reign of Augustus, he might be compelled to conceal what he really thinks. The Aeneid is a long poem. Reason and passion are opposed. Now, that's a bit of an exaggeration, but not too much. I really have received paragraphs like this. Usually the individual sentences are much more interesting. You know, it's not something like the Aeneid is a long poem. It will be a very interesting sentence about the Aeneid being a long poem, followed by a very interesting sentence about reason and passion being opposed. But at their core, it doesn't matter if it's interesting or not interesting. The fact is, the ideas are just not really following from one another. They're all new, they're all good, but they're coming from an oracle, okay? And oracle is not the model you want. Oracles do not make people grading your papers happy. Okay, so how do we fix this? One way of correcting the problem is by focusing on one agent or actor and rearranging the sentences so that the actions follow from one another. And here I am shamelessly tapping into another concept altogether, which is that your reader likes action, and your reader likes to follow one person doing an action. Okay, so if you're pretending that that your essay is like a movie, the camera is following one person, dropping his pencil, leaning over, picking it up, writing with it, which is still a very boring movie, but a lot more easy to follow than this person doing this person doing this, pan shot to the whole room, and then zooming into the guy checking his email. I mean, and you're thinking, okay, where am I supposed to look here? I don't understand what's important. So choose an agent and think about what's the level, what's the action, what's the sequence you want to focus it on. So I've done a little bit of rearranging here. And I've chosen Virgil as my agent. Number 11. Virgil writes under the reign of Augustus, and consistently throughout this very long poem, he opposes reason and passion. Virgil shows Dido following love and Aeneas following duty, the latter supported by the gods and by Jupiter in particular. When Virgil emphasizes how important it is to obey rational authority, might he be flattering Augustus? Now, did you follow that? Same sentences, same ideas, but they're actually linking, they're linked in a way that First, I think, picks up on many of the concepts that Mrs. Niebuhr was talking about in terms of logical connections. Yes? Somewhat. And there are many ways of analyzing the logical links, but the important thing is that there is a logical connection. But also, notice that that we are now using, when Virgil wrote his poem, is that's introduced as background information. The possibility that he might have shaped his poem in according to this context then is the new information that I want to stress. Okay? I return to Virgil as the agent and offer some examples, stressing that of Aeneas and his support from Jupiter. So, in a way, those two examples, Virgil shows Dido falling love and Aeneas falling duty, that is actually presuming the background information of opposing reason and passion. It's an example of them, of that opposition. The stress on rational authority is repeated as background information in the last sentence, right? When Virgil emphasizes how important it is to obey rational authority. That also is background information here. And it's now and then followed by the new information at the end. Might he be flattering Augustus? So we are in no doubt that the neat new idea that the student has come up with is this idea that perhaps Virgil might be flattering Augustus, which got buried in the very middle of number 10, right? And if the student came in and said, no, I could see it in my head. I was looking at all these things, and the important thing for me was this relation to Augustus, and he's concealing what he really thinks. I would say, well, where is that idea? And he would say, see, it's right here, right in the middle of the paragraph. And I would say, well, we need to set it up, and you have all the tools, all the information, all the pieces here. It's just a matter of setting it up and being aware that that's the new insight, the new information that you want to emphasize to your reader. Now, what's happening here then is a form of linking. And number 12 is sort of spelling that out. Every sentence has some sort of old information, I think, and some sort of new information. And one way of linking your sentences, a string of agents doing this, an example, is that this is not the only way, but one way that makes your reader happy is by linking the old and new information, where the new information becomes old in each case and then proceeds in a logical sequence, so that the as we got from linking sentences 1 and 3 together. Now, let me just pause for a moment. Are there exceptions? Times where you put your new information first. And this is important because I don't want you to walk away from this as an ironclad rule. It's a psychological rule. But I'm not really a big fan of airtight generalizations, because so often there really are exceptions. Sometimes the new information that you want to say is really short, and the old information is really long. And I know that sounds kind of silly, but usually what your reader likes is like short old information. You know, and that's when you can use nominalization sometimes, you know, because you've already explained what the diametrical opposition is between, you know, how the dialectical opposition. Maybe you might want to say that Odysseus and Penelope are engaged in a kind of philosophical dialectic that is like a Socratic dialogue. And then the old information might just be, and then you want to move on and say, but you know, unlike Socrates, their ending is marriage and love, something like that. So what you can do is just say in that case, despite the Socratic dialectic, comma, you know, their aim is very different and aims towards the, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so you have this old information that's compressed. It's compressed, it's old, so you can compress it. It's not just dropped out of the sky new, but because it's linked neatly and nicely, And you don't just use this without as a pronoun without a modifier, because sometimes you have no idea what's happening. Flesh out the this what, this dialectic, this something, this relationship, this verb, this noun. Tell me what the this is. But nonetheless, the this is going in the right direction because you're pointing back to something that the reader knows, and then you have a longer description of your new information. But let's say you want to conclude that Penelope exhibits the virtue of a good statesman. So look at number 13. Here is rigid compliance with the stress position rule. Okay, by holding out the prospect that she will marry one of the suitors and thereby setting them against one another so that they compete against one another instead of attacking her or Odysseus's kingdom, Penelope exhibits the virtue of a good statesman. Okay, so your point here is you want to say Penelope is a good statesman. All right. Does that sound good? I don't know. Something's not working for me. I'm still a little bit disoriented as a reader. So maybe in this case, I want to do something else. I want to switch it around just because I have too much old information. And I want to put the longer stuff at the end because the shorter stuff should be at the beginning. Here's what it looked, number 14. Penelope exhibits the virtue of a good statesman by holding out the prospect that she will marry one of the suitors, thereby setting them against one another, forcing them to compete against one another instead of attacking her or Odysseus's kingdom. Sorry, there was a misprint there. I should say, by holding out the prospect that she will marry one of the suitors, thereby setting them against one another, forcing them to compete against one another instead of attacking her or Odysseus's kingdom. Now, there it's pretty clear that my point is that I still want to say that Penelope is a really good statesman or has the virtues of a statesman, but it would be clumsy to put that at the very end. Question: is there some way of still utilizing the stress position effect here? Is there some way that we could drive home the new information, not by rearranging number 14, but by doing something with punctuation? This is kind of a trick question, like guess a number between 1 and 5 million. Anyone? I have a thought in mind, but I wasn't sure if, and this is now also touching back to earlier talks on punctuation. From last year, if you attended last year's talks. What if you put a dash before the or? Let me read this again. Penelope exhibits the virtue of a good statesman by holding out the prospect that she will marry one of the suitors, thereby setting them against one another, forcing them to compete against one another instead of attacking her. Or Odysseus's kingdom. Okay, the dash is a very strong form of punctuation, right? You don't want to overuse dashes. You will sound like a crazy person or Emily Dickinson. Actually, that would be great to sound like Emily Dickinson. But you have to be Emily Dickinson. And so just overusing dashes, not good. But judicious use of dash, very good. Because it has the effect of emphasizing something, setting something apart. And in this case, notice how Odysseus's kingdom is actually recapitulating this idea of statesmanship. Because a kingdom is a political concept, right? And so that dash is almost like a pointer back to kingdom. It makes your reader connect that kingdom back with statesmanship. So you have your cake and eat it too. You get to have your nice coherent sentence at the beginning, a short point at the beginning. You get to elaborate it in a way that, you know, your reader's following along. And then you get to put a point on it at the end by coming back to that idea of kingdom. Notice the point is not buried in the middle at all. All right, now what about the level of the document? Over and over, you have heard from your professors, from these colloquia, from the writing lab, that you need to put your point or thesis first. get your claim onto the table, and then show the argument that compels us to agree with it. Introduce your idea at the beginning of the paragraph so that your reader can approach your evidence with it in mind. And before you leave the room, there's nothing wrong with that. They're still right. That is a good point to keep, to put your point first. I am not, but I shouldn't embarrass people. But every once in a while when people leave before, you know, when you're about to say the counter argument, you go, no, don't leave just after reading the prince. Wait till you get to the Republic. Well, I really like the stuff about Machiavelli. Now I can go and like shaft people left and right. It's like, no, that's not the takeaway point from the core. Please don't do that. Telling the advice that the point should come first is old information, and it is correct old information. But I would like to balance it, because as helpful as signposts are for your readers want to feel that they're going somewhere, right? They don't want to feel, you know, this idea where you say what you're going to say, you say it, and then you say what you've said. It's kind of a recipe for morons, isn't it? I mean, it's like thwonk, thwonk, thwonk. A little bit of that is good, but you have to disguise it, right? You have to set up your point, and then you have to elaborate it. And then when you do restate your point, as Mr. Marchetti pointed out so eloquently, it ought to be in a deeper, improved, new, deeper form, right? It shouldn't just be cut and paste the same sentence again, you know, because that's just, yeah. It has no life behind it. Now, how do you open up your point? This is a big problem, and I'm not going to go into that too much because Mr. Marchetti did a lovely job, I think, of exhorting you to leave your reader with questions. Open up, what's at stake? Where do you want your reader to go? Look at the end of Crime and Punishment. I don't know if you've read it, but the end of Crime and Punishment is a beautiful example. You get to the end of a book, and all of a sudden he says, what's going to happen? All these things are going to happen, but that's another book, right? It's just the most fabulous ending because you get the feeling that you're not just like, okay, then he dies. It's this whole new world that's going to open up, and the reader is so happy when that happens. You might also want to consider a point last paper. That is to say, sometimes having the point at the very end. However, these are very hard to write. This is like handing out matches here before preschool. It's like, here you go, kids. Have fun. Bye. Point last papers can burn you, okay? Because the most of the time you write them. Why? Because that's when you get your idea at the end. And you arrive at your idea at 3 a.m. after working through the passage. And that's not how you write an artful point last paper for your reader. In order to have an artful point last paper, what you need to do is set up cues all the way along. So let's just say that my real point here is that women can be statesmen, because I've been dropping these examples of Penelope and Andromache and the wisdom of women in classical epic as actually being a alternative to some masculine ideal of Thumos or Kleos or something like that, okay? Maybe that could be my point, right? I would have to develop it a lot more artfully, but you get the idea, right? You've dropped these ideas along, and that those skillful manipulation of descriptive words can guide your reader to the end, to a point before you've even formulated it. Another way of guiding your reader towards a point that you've not yet made explicit is to write what I like to call, because I love London, a double-decker paper. You write a paper about a point, you make that point clear at the beginning, but by the end you show that there's also a deeper point, right? So the deeper point is the thing that might be dearest to your heart, and that you can introduce that in your conclusion. So, for example, my deeper point might be that the way I end my remarks isn't really important because the stress position should lie with you. So I'm going to have a really lame conclusion in order to leave 5 minutes for Q&A, right? That's a double-decker point, because the point isn't just getting you to think about this concept that I'm offering you, but to get you to think about the concept that I'm offering you. So I hope it's valuable to have thought about it. And are there questions? Francis.
You mentioned a point last position paper, mm-hmm. which I understand is a paper where you make the point you were driving at all along, rather than this. But I also thought you were insinuating there's another alternative to the paper, which perhaps you mentioned earlier. Can you catch it? What is that? What is the alternative to the point last position paper?
The paper in which you state your thesis or point up front. So that's the one that's the most friendly to your reader, right? Because that's the one where you give your reader the goggles, you know, to say, here you go, look at the book, look at the lines this way, here's where we're going. Here's this thing, here's the reason I'm reading you this quotation. So just so you know, it's gonna be incoherent, heads up, now I'm gonna read it, got it? And you think, whew, I like that. And the same goes for the whole document. If you can be nice to your reader. And the reason that this is important is not, it's not a control issue. It's a reader limitation issue. If we had had an hour for the evidence talk last week, I would have loved even more discussion of how, when students use evidence, how differently students can, and scholars, can read the very same line. Right? I mean, you can read the same line and read it very differently, and that's why you have to prepare your reader for how you're going to be reading the line. And sometimes it's helpful to say how someone else might be reading the line as well. And simply throwing the line out there without any preparation can be confusing. You have to do it gingerly because it might not be having the effect you want. You know, your reader is dense. Your reader is always dense. And you have to write dense proof writing. Even your professors who, you know, they might have advanced degrees, but they are not mind readers. And so you have to be kindly towards them and say, here's how I can help you get to my point. And this, you know, here's how I read this line. You know, don't be afraid of saying that, because so often they'll have a stack of papers where other people are quoting the same line very differently. So that really is, I would say, you know, in general, the best way of proceeding. However, I mean, there are some topics, for example, if you're answering a question, what are the causes of X? And then your paper might go through, is it this, 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 or is it this? Now, it might still be more effective to have your point at the beginning so that your reader is going to know why A, B, C, D, and E are not yet adequate answers. However, if you want to include little hints of your answer in each of these other answers, then it will all fall into place. And that's what you want in a point last paper. You don't want the big surprise out of the blue. You do not want the deus ex machina lowered onto the stage, a big balloon, like, oh, look over here. You know, it's like a murder mystery where the clues weren't there. You know, it's like, well, actually, Elmer did it. It's like, well, there was no Elmer in the book, and you feel ripped off. It's like, no, it only works if the clues were all there, right? And that's the pleasure. It's like, oh, I get it. I get it now. I know it was all about women being good political leaders. Yay, you know, that, you know, or whatever the thing is. You know, and honestly, I wasn't intending that to happen. That just sort of happened to be what was there. But, you know, if the clues are there, then this big point at the end is exciting for the reader. If it's just something you dropped out of the blue, then what was the point of what came before? You know, it doesn't have that same rhetorical power. Was there another question up at the back row? Yes.
Yeah, I'm actually wondering about 13 and 14.
Yes.
It seems to me, I like this a lot, but I wonder if those sentences could like come at potentially different points in the essay, too, that the first one almost seems to me like really what like Mr. Marchetti talked about in his talk is kind of like having a single sentence is something of a summation by putting kind of the points first and and then
13 is a summation.
Yeah. It has like it has a summation feel, whereas 14 kind of has an introductory feel. But I'm just wondering if those kinds of sentences were some would be more appropriate at certain points, different points in the essay.
That's an excellent observation, and I agree with you. 13 is a lot more coherent if all of that old information really is old information, like it's old, so you can follow it. If you're not sure what happens in the Odyssey, then what's going on in that sentence? You have no idea. So how old is the old information? How comfortable is the reader with that amount of old information? And the 14 I don't actually think is that great of a sentence, although I like it with the dash, because with the dash there, then it is linking the something about kingdom, statesmanship, Odysseus. It seems to move in richer directions. It sort of gets us to think about what is politics? What are the parameters? How do we define politics? How do we define statesmanship? What is the boundary between the domestic and the political, which is a wonderful question. But yes, not meaning to sound like too much of a relativist, but this does sound kind of relativistic, that so much is contextual here on what effect you want. And all I want you to think about is that the reader irresistibly expects this stress position, and so knowing that, you can use it to your advantage. And don't bury your points. I see this over and over and over in student papers where sometimes they'll just start with their point and then ending with old information, it's like taking the wind out of the balloon. And often this is the sort of thing you can catch when you're editing. You have this great idea and then you follow it up with something from the earlier in the paragraph. And it just loses all its force. So don't sell yourself short. Don't squander the gift of this. Thank you so much.